Okay, we're ready to get started. This is 164, Negotiating Religious Conflict Through Dream Analysis, the Pre-Process of Becoming and Beloving. And the presenter is Galen Anderson, who has a PhD in English. She's taught at BYU, SLCC, U of U, for 17 years, and she's currently teaching at UVU, and she's the mother of six sons. She figured that was good enough for her introduction, so we'll be hearing from her for part one, and then part two, we'll be hearing from Eugene Kovalenko. Okay. And he'll be discussing the pre-process as well. Thank you.
Or I'm hoping that he'll help us go through a mini dream analysis, those who would like to participate in that, or an analysis of a personal experience. I've got my prepared talk, which I will shortly launch into, but I wanted to, after hearing some of the sessions today, I wanted to frame what I have to say just a little bit, because coming and hearing people's comments and so on, I'm realizing how varied the audience is here at Sunstone. And I've been distraught and upset at some of the things I've heard, and I suspect that some of you might feel the same way about some of the things you'll hear here. And so I wanted to give you a little bit of my perspective on why I'm talking about this, so that if this offends you immediately, you can feel free to leave now or at any time, or, you know, or stay if you wish. I'm focusing on Carl Jung's theories and dream analysis not to valorize a non-scientific or touchy-feely or even a religious preference to solving human problems or addressing the human condition. If I had to choose up sides, I think I'd vote on the side of science. It seems so clear-cut. At least before I became a rhetorician, I thought it was. At this point, I do believe science has a rhetoric. Jung says that science, if we're left only with science, that, let me get this statement that he made, which is kind of interesting. We're left with scientific approaches to human psychology, abstract, rational, but so remarkably unenlightening and devoid of interest. And so I want to go beyond that. But the reason I think Jung and dreams can be so helpful is because of the powerful grip that religion and mysticism and tradition and the occult even have on a large percentage of the world's population, and the grip that our own emotions and the unconscious, I think, have on all of us, every human being, and that this is dangerous. So if we are raised to believe, which I was certainly to some degree, and I might refer to my great-grandmother, that the world is Babylon and that God wants us to, at age 16 with my twin sister, marry a 38-year-old patriarch and be continually pregnant. And if we're raised to believe that, we're going to have to grapple with that and those social constructions. No matter how much we believe we are free to choose, no matter how much education we get and how unconstrained we feel, how do we grapple with those teachings and those beliefs that are so deeply ingrained? How do we communicate across the gulf between cultures and worldviews that are reinforced by religious tradition? So that's my perspective of why I'm addressing this topic. Now my prepared remarks. On June 30th, 2008, in my Word Combined Relief Society priesthood class, a brother made a comment that I immediately wrote down about, quote, "how much the Spirit has taught me while I'm asleep," end quote. Of course, the premise of this talk is that we may indeed learn while asleep from our dreams, and that dream analysis can be one helpful means of revealing, understanding, or even resolving personal religious conflict. As an example of such revelation, in the novel Wuthering Heights, The young protagonist, Kathy, questions her surrogate mother, the housekeeper, Ellen Dean. Nellie, do you never dream queer dreams?
Yes, now and then.
And so do I. I've dreamt in my life dreams that have stayed with me ever after and changed my ideas. They've gone through and through me like wine through water and altered the color of my mind. And this is one. I'm going to tell it. Oh, don't, Miss Catherine. We're dismal enough without conjuring up ghosts and visions to perplex us. Come, come, be merry and like yourself. But Kathy insists. If I were in heaven, Nellie, I should be extremely miserable. Because you're not fit to go there. All sinners would be miserable in heaven. But it's not for that. I dreamt once I was there. Heaven did not seem to be my home. And I broke my heart with weeping to come back to earth. And the angels were so angry that they flung me out into the middle of the heap on the top of Wuthering Heights, where I woke sobbing for joy. Kathy's dream reveals her true home on earth, not in a heaven constructed by her religious teachings. This poignant dream narrative makes me wonder, where do I belong? Where do you belong? Since I don't have access to God's judgment to determine the answers, maybe our dreams like Kathy's will offer insight. Maybe the Spirit will teach us. Perhaps the assessment of belonging depends as well upon our definition of what heaven or home entails. The author of Wuthering Heights, Emily Bronte, daughter of a clergyman, was well versed in Anglican views of heaven and hell. She structures her novel with other dreams at its beginning. The dreamer is the narrator of the story, Lockwood, who suffers a particularly awful nightmare about listening to a famous preacher. Good God, what a sermon! Divided into 490 parts, each part fully equal to an ordinary address from the pulpit, and each discussing a separate sin. Lockwood is miserable, listening infinitum. How I writhed and yawned and nodded and pinched and pricked myself for enduring the sermon's end. And rubbed my eyes and stood up and sat down again. Well, he endured to the end, but his reward, when the 491st sin was proclaimed, is to be publicly exposed and excommunicated. The whole assembly, exalting their pilgrim staves, rushed around to beat him. Lockwood endured church only to be excommunicated and beat up. Kathy is flung out of heaven. Similarly, we've seen Mormons cast out of the assembly. I've also heard Mormons say they just don't belong, that they don't fit in with those church people. They feel beat up and condemned as they try to endure sermonizing from the so-called righteous. What do these juxtapositions mean? Psychiatrist Carl Jung points out that the individual psyche is only valid in the eyes of churches when it, quote, acknowledges their dogmas, when it surrenders to a collective category. The will to an individuality is regarded as egoistic obstinacy, end quote. Jung actually finds this ironic in comparison to the professed goals of Christianity, which in his view, quote, regards this individuation process as the incarnation and revelation of God himself. Hence, the development of the self acquires a significance whose full implications have hardly begun to be appreciated, end quote. In Kathy's dream that altered the color of her mind, heaven was unwelcoming, undesirable. Perhaps some of you have experienced former binaries of good and evil suddenly reversed positions. I recall that happened to me in high school. It was disconcerting and I sobbed, like Kathy did. I'll share that incident in a minute, as well as examples from my students, with the goal of acknowledging difficulties that young members of the church and their parents face when values conflict. Information about church history, scholarly research, internet sources, societal shifts in values, and in some, education itself can change the way members see themselves in relationship to authoritative doctrines and practices. If resultant conflict is not resolved, Mormons may struggle with painful levels of cognitive and emotional dissonance. Other members simply feel unwelcome or harshly judged by dictates of right and wrong as they make lifestyle choices or practice unsanctioned behaviors. As a tentative solution, I suggest that as we grapple with conflict, practices derived from Jung's theory of individuation may help us learn to trust ourselves. Jung believed that humans' coping resource, the unconscious, leads us toward growth, mental health, peace. A particularly dream analysis methodology created by Eugene Kovalenko uniquely fosters the spirit of Jung's ideas in its emphasis on individual dreamer as analyst. The dreamer visualizes, questions, experiences the aha moment and thereby learns, creates, writes, understands, and becomes. Now I want to briefly review some of Jung's relevant concepts. And these slides I'm quoting mostly directly from James Hall's Jungian Dream Interpretation from his book. But rather than just read the slides, I figure you can look over there and read those. I'm going to paraphrase some of the same ideas in what I have here. He labels, Jung labels the individual sense of identity as ego. Cultural influences shape ego development, but the ego's primary influence comes from parents. One learns from mom and dad or other authorities what is good and acceptable behavior. The opposite of the good, those feelings or tendencies others around us find unacceptable, are pushed beneath the surface into the shadow of unconsciousness. In addition to the ego-shadow dichotomy, another of Jung's key notions is that of the animus. When one falls in love, one projects an ideal image, anima or animus, upon the loved person. Now, in Hall's book, he addresses primarily heterosexual projections. I'm acknowledging that there's other possibilities, but I'm not going to discuss those. Jung asserts that such projections are unrealistic and often unrelated to the projection the loved one, in turn, focuses back either on the lover or perhaps on a completely different person. Following on the Wuthering Heights example, Kathy's animus figure is the lower class Heathcliff with whom she feels deep union. Quote, he's more myself than I am. Whatever our souls are made of, his and mine are the same. Hence her classic pronouncement, I am Heathcliff. Her animus projection stands in stark contrast to her ego's expectations of a proper marriage with a man approved by society and religion. Kathy, of course, obeys ego's demands and marries the wealthy Linton to perform her appropriate social role. Ego requires performance. Jung labels the social role as persona, derived from the Greek word for mask. The social role enables culture and society to function, but the individual wearing the mask or persona may well feel empty, lacking inner authenticity or individuation. In Kathy's case, persona's performance sickens and ultimately kills her. She says, I'm weak. My brain got confused and I screamed unconsciously. She begs Nellie, don't say anything, but stay with me. I dread sleeping. My dreams appall me. Finally, Heathcliff adjures Kathy in her final illness. Why did you betray your own heart, Kathy? You loved me. Then what right had you to leave me? What right, answer me, for the poor fancy you felt for Linton? Because misery and degradation and death and nothing that God or Satan could inflict would have parted us. You, of your own will, did it. Kathy attempted to act the lady. She tried to do the right thing, the thing that society prescribed, but ironically, the socially constructed ego can be a deceiver. Self-martyrdom, apparent unselfishness, can be more unwise than acting in true self-interest. It's important to note that what Jung describes as individuation is not the same as what popular culture today calls individualism. Because individualism is roundly condemned as narcissistic selfishness, it's disconcerting to realize that for Jung, the very source of egocentric, narcissistic tendencies is unhealthy over-identification with collective cultural roles. In Mormon culture, such roles obviously might be missionary, mother, father, church leader, etc. A woman overly identified with her role as mother, whose children leave home, as mine have recently done, may experience empty nest syndrome or lack of identity. A more healthy alternative, Jung asserts, is finding and developing a sense of inner potential. Kathy's dream warned her against marriage as performance and insisted that her true home was with Heathcliff on Wuthering Heights. Dreams, then, challenge and compensate for ego distortions. Someone who represses anger because it is socially inappropriate may re-experience her legitimate anger in a dream. Dreams signal when ego is leading us away from authentic personal growth and challenge our everyday dominant ego-driven moods and identity. Let me acknowledge, however, that the term authentic may be problematic for some of us social constructionists and postmodernists or post-structuralists. I'll stipulate a definition of authenticity then as self attempting to intervene in its own social construction. rather than acquiescing to the rule of outside forces. Writing might be the appropriate metaphor. To what extent do we let others write our lives? And to what extent do we rewrite that script? Jung believes that individuation is a process of script rewriting that occurs not only in young adulthood into maturity, but also even in one's latest years. The script is continually rewritten. Dream analysis can aid individuation, but individuation is not dependent on understanding dreams. Unless outside forces intervene, such as a highly authoritarian culture or environment, each person ideally moves, pushed by the unconscious, toward individuation. Religious conflict and cognitive dissonance may signal that one is stuck, clinging tightly to one's mask, too conscious of the religious audience to allow such growth to occur. In psychoanalysis, Jung says that, quote, for once in his life, the patient might be offered a relationship that does not repeat the nauseating you should, you must, and similar confessions of impotence against the onslaught from outside, no less than against its repercussions in the psyche of the individual. The doctor sees himself obliged to play the role of counsel for the defense. Jung goes on to note that, naturally, society has an indisputable right to protect itself against errant subjectivisms. But insofar as society itself is composed of de-individualized persons, it is completely at the mercy of ruthless individualists. Let it band together in groups and organizations as much as it likes. It is just this banding together and the resultant extinction of the individual personality that makes it succumb so readily to a dictator. A million zeros joined together do not, unfortunately, add up to one. To avoid the zero-sum personality, then, education provides another means towards individuation. Or at least I'm proposing that it does. John Rothbard, literary critic, argues that although education is interested in truth, its unconditional concern is for the growth and development of the student. Education has two primary functions: to train students in the methods and skills required by the professions and to clarify values. Based on those criteria, I was very fortunate in high school. I had a very fine teacher. I don't know if any of you know him. I haven't talked to him since high school. It's been a long time. His name is Larry Haslam. The overwhelming majority of students at Logan High School, Logan, Utah, were white, Mormon, and middle class, and there were rigid hierarchies of popularity. On the lowest social rung were individuals essentially marginalized by difference, poverty, dress, behavior, religion, and occasionally marked intelligence. Mr. Haslam uniquely contravened our school's social boundaries, speaking respectfully to students, disregarded not only by their peers but also by other teachers. Alongside his respect for the minority, Mr. Haslam challenged the assumptions, worldview, and perspectives of the majority. He imported a group of African-American students from Ogden to speak to our white classroom. Their voices troubled me and complicated my thinking about race. In subsequent discussions with my father, I struggled in tears with awareness that Mormon beliefs suddenly appeared wrong, racist. When I became a writing teacher, I wanted to do two things: respect students in their differences, and at the same time engage them with wide-ranging ideas, help them look outside the box of their beliefs. Such practice seems to be the purpose of education. Resultant conflict and cognitive dissonance instigate actually a productive stance for writing and research, but the question becomes how to make dissonance productive rather than fearful. I always ask my students to ask a lot of questions when they encounter new ideas before they refute or reject them. One day a student approached me after class to express her worry. She said, "Questioning seems dangerous to me. It just doesn't feel safe." When I asked her why, she cited a talk from the previous weekend's general conference. A male student visited my office somewhat in despair. He was dumbfounded when his BYU biology professor taught evolution. He couldn't sleep. He stayed up late researching, reading everything he'd get his hands on from LDS leaders past and present. I told him that was a good thing. He didn't necessarily agree. Another BYU student, African-American, chose to research early black members of the church. Because he was struggling with methodology, I accompanied him to the Harold B. Lee Library Special Collections. Together, we read original texts from Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. I hadn't encountered their words previously myself and was shocked. He was devastated to encounter racist intonation. How could prophets think and talk that way? Students often introduce questions of belief or unbelief into their research and writing projects. Thus, I've been exposed to their difficulties during my 17 years teaching in Utah. In a personal essay, a student wrote about how surprised and embarrassed he was during his first visit to the temple by rituals that didn't make sense. While reading his words, I flashed back to my own wedding endowment day, how I was taken back by the violence of the covenant, certain grammar, depiction of other denominations, church officials. Yet that day I watched my father, dressed in strange clothing, but with tears of affirmative meaning in his eyes. I adored and trusted my dad. I still do. His articulate and heartfelt testimony always makes tears run down my face. Jung makes the relevant point that church experience offers individuals the sense that they are part of something meaningful. It offers them social community. The problem occurs when that, quote, favorable environment merely strengthens the dangerous tendency to expect everything to originate from outside. Even that metamorphosis which external reality cannot provide, namely a deep-seated change of the inner man or woman. Writing that examines personal experience that grapples with inner change forces the writer and reader to confront tough questions. Whom do we trust? What values and whose values do we subscribe to? What evidence is worth citing? Does scientific criteria determine our decision-making? Jung believed that human instincts are so powerful, based as they are on deep archetypal associations, that, quote, they cannot be grasped intellectually, and when one has destroyed one manifestation of them, they reappear in an altered form, end quote. Why would any of us block instincts or destroy their manifestations? Jung believed the answer is fear. Instinctual impulses are frightening when faced with community, cultural, and religious expectations. An individual may well want to avoid facing forces of the unconscious psyche. The problem is, according to Jung, that such fear prevents self-knowledge. Often, he says, the fear is so great that one dares not admit it, even to oneself. Here is a question that every religious person should consider very seriously. He might get an illuminating answer, end quote. A student in a course that I taught at the University of Utah described his learning to rethink, learning to write process. And I'm going to cite him anonymously, even though he gave me permission to cite this. But he said, in my previous writing, I often found myself falling into highly emotive reactions and drawing unfounded conclusions. My epistemological revolution began when I embraced the idea of critical thinking. My thinking has changed from accepting things as a system of black and white truths to an acceptance of facts only when they are proved by empirical evidence or rational argument. With this revolution of thinking, there has been more cognitive dissonance than at any time in my life. The height of cognitive dissonance came when researching and after writing my paper. His research focused on Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses. I learned that in many cases an appeal to religious thought can be as an objective moral truth can be dangerous. This challenged my previous beliefs, and in many ways I have found myself revising, suspending judgment until further evidence can be shown. It has changed my life. Such life changes and the conflicts I've described may lead to all kinds of coping strategies. Writing appears to be one of the most helpful and productive of such strategies. I want to share with you my experience at a rather remarkable writing seminar. Of course, the event was not labeled as necessarily about creative writing. In December of 2007, I attended a workshop on dream analysis in New Mexico led by Eugene Kovalenko. Most of my prior knowledge of dream analysis came from Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams, and I subscribed to Freud's view that despite dreams' tendency to mask repressed wishes, dream content or the dream narrative often springs from unimportant and random remnants of day residue. In other words, that dream content is mostly nonsense. I was therefore skeptical of the value of analyzing nonsensical content, especially dreamers' self-analysis. But I dutifully participated with others in what Eugene calls the Cree process in answering a series of questions about a chosen dream. If you see the first five letters, C-R-E-E-I, Cree is an acronym for the first five questions in the series that ask about the dream's clarity, the role responsibility of the dreamer, the emotion, whether the dreamer expresses him or herself, and if the dreamer interacts with others. Each member of the group scored his or her dream on a communal chart without sharing the story or narrative of their dream, thus complete privacy was retained about what might have been sensitive material. Eugene asked us to be aware of our reactions as we answered questions. Often people experience a moment of insight, what he calls the aha moment, as they reflect on the dream's specific details and circumstances. While Eugene draws from a number of theoretical sources as background and inspiration in addition to Jung, He warns that intellectualizing the process in advance may interfere with the experience and diminish its potential for learning and inspiration. Despite that warning, I couldn't shut off my critical observing self, and what I began to realize as I both participated and observed was that each dreamer was engaging in a creative process of reflection, analysis, writing, very similar to what the students in my classes experience. I can't summarize the contents of the day-long workshop here, but for me, the culminating event was a writing activity, the writing of a three-stanza poem. The first stanza is to be written objectively to replicate the dream and its Cree scores. In the second, subjective stanza, the writer is free to change the dream, reject, or question it. The third stanza is labeled transformative. The writer chooses words that will elicit a transformative analysis score. Eugene explains the third stanza experience. Quote, "The very act of writing these words actually makes changes in you, and they are permanent. That is the creative process. That is what artists do, be they poets, writers, composers, painters, sculptors. They struggle with their inner and outer monsters and demons, trying to transform them. If they don't succeed at first, then they try again. But with new ideas or insights the next time until they achieve something transformative." I witnessed workshop participants grappling with deep-seated personal conflicts and finding a sense of transformative possibility. Really a rather remarkable experience. Eugene mentioned in his talk earlier, he's gone. There are many ways to develop self-knowledge, such as marriage, the raising of children, teaching, biofeedback, contemplation, meditation, conversation, prayer, imagination, crises, war, combat, hypnosis, psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, kinesiology, good reading, etc. He adds and puts dream analysis at the top of that list, and I suggest that writing is the other key addition. In Jung's words, the creation of something new is not accomplished by the intellect, but by the play instinct, acting from inner necessity. The creative mind plays with the objects it loves. Now I'm going to get a little bit personal here for the end of this paper. While I'm still a novice at dream analysis, I'll share an insight that came while writing this paper. As I was thinking about a dream that I had discussed and scored with Eugene. The dream involved, as my dreams often do, walking in the air, not being subject to the law of gravity. My flying ability is tied to faith. As long as I believe, I transcend gravity. When I doubt, I sink. In this dream, I saw my family below threatened by floodwaters, but being elevated, I couldn't get their attention to warn them. A group of students, however, escaped the flood safely as they moved from a flooded school building past the house where my family was trapped and hiked towards higher ground. The final two questions on the Cree chart are relevant here. If you can see the bottom two questions there. In the dream, are you becoming all that you can be? Which I would interpret as, are you growing and helping others in the dream to do so also? Well, my answer is ambiguous. I am becoming in the sense that I'm able to rise, walk on air. I sense that my flight is important to my own development. Even students in the dream are moving to higher ground, but my family is left behind. And then, in the dream, are you beloving of all human beings? Eugene's invented word, beloving, represents a way of being, a way of loving others and self that promotes the well-being and health of all. The answer here, again, is a question mark. And question marks are key points for analysis. Yes, I love my family. I want to warn them. I love walking on air. I'm happy when the students escape. But I can't let my family know of my love. They can't see me. So again, the answer is not a clear yes or no. Eugene commented at the time I shared this dream that if I were trying to help my family, that just maybe my separation from them could be part of the problem. Although I heard his words, my realization about the dream came much later. And I don't think these things are ever finally decided. I think these dreams can be reinterpreted over years of rethinking. So last month, as I was writing this paper and reflecting on Cree analysis, the insight came that my unintentional coping strategy for religious conflict in my own life has been to strictly compartmentalize. Even though I've spoken at Sunstone on three previous occasions, not one member of my immediate or extended family has attended my presentations, nor have I invited them to do so. Only on one occasion has a family member, my husband, attended my numerous talks at academic conferences over the past 17 years, many of which have dealt with the intersection between academic and religious thought, or Mormon issues. In addition, on Sundays and at home, I live in a Mormon environment, but in so many ways, I feel alone, surrounded by what seem to be institutionally mandated literalisms and fundamentalisms. I hesitate to share much of my thinking about religion with my family, although I share some, because I anticipate painful conflict and disagreement. Perhaps angels casting me out of heaven? I already know well how they disagree with my political thinking. Perhaps those who most witness my value for critical thinking are my students, just as the students in the dream escaped the dangerous floodwaters. Could critical thinking be the savior in this scenario? Are members of my family threatened by a flood of religiosity without the benefit of a perspective that has at times, if not rescued me, at least mediated the church-related anxiety, pain, and suffering of this Mormon mother? And so I brought some pictures of them today, since they're not here. Of my six sons, I'm the wife of a high priest, sister of faithful and non, daughter of bishop and pioneer stalwart mother, and grandmother of visionaries and granddaughter of visionaries and polygamists, and grandmother of Casey, Trevor, Megan, Brielle, Sierra, and Colin. To what extent do these social roles, these personas, define me? Like Kathy, I continue to search for home, the place where I belong. I suggest that our dreams may help us define what composes home or heaven and what hell might entail. I suggest that our writings in school, at Sunstone, in poetry, or in dream analysis may transform our religious conflicts, those inner demons, into created meaning. My hope is for the courage to both fly and to knit together the fragments of life into something of value. Jung believed that, quote, what is healthy for one dominant ego image at a particular stage of life may be decidedly unhealthy for the nascent ego image at the next stage of life. Psychologically, as in other areas of life, the good is the enemy of the better. Individuation is a dynamic process. It involves constant change. So now, to that end, I requested if Eugene would be here today and talk a little bit more about his process and maybe conduct a kind of a group dream analysis, if that works.
Not enough, huh?
There's probably not quite enough handouts, but there's a website listed, and so if you'd like to go to the free website, it's a lot of material has been put together by Dr. Robert Bexit and also Eugene.
You might get that web address.
The web address is www.cree.org. It's that simple. Cree, and you know how to spell it, CREEI.org. This is the results of the workshop that Gay Lynn talked about and Rob Beckstead participated in last December in Los Alamos. We won't go into this, but I thought we could... I want you all... How much time do we have? 25 minutes.
Yep, 25.
This reminds me of an experience when I was invited to attend the board of directors meeting of a foundation, and I was expecting to give a whole afternoon workshop.
Gene, use the microphone.
Oh, please. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. This reminds me of when I was invited to give a board of directors meeting at a philosophic foundation in Sedona, Arizona, some years ago. And I thought I was being invited to give a workshop that afternoon. Well, it turns out they had all kinds of things to do. And when it came to my turn, the chairman turned to me and he said, Dr. Kovalenko, you have 20 minutes. Give us an image. Well, I'm going to do that. We have about that now. So I would like you to think of a dream. It can be a recent dream. It can be an old dream. And if you don't have a dream in mind, if you can't think of one, then think of an experience. I prefer a dream because the dream bypasses the ego. Okay. How many people, and I'd like somebody to count this, how many people have something in mind? Can you count the number? Just take the number. Keep it, keep them up while we get the comment. Okay. And how many of those 25? Oh, how many of those 25 are not a dream? Oh, how many of those 25 are not a dream? Okay, it's just one. So we've got. All right. Now I'm going to ask you a series of questions. The questions that we've already referred to. Let me have that. And with regard to these questions, there's just three options: yes, no, or I don't know. So I'm going to ask the first question about this dream. How many of you 25 will answer, is it clear in your mind? And what I'm saying, what I mean clear, is not whether you understand or comprehend it. Can you describe it? Yes or no? How many yeses? Would you? And how many no's?
That would be three.
Well,
no, maybe not.
Not necessarily.
Okay, how many no's? Any no's? One.
And how many don't know? That
two.
Could be two.
Yeah.
So somebody's not voting. Okay, well.
Do you want somebody else to mark, Eugene? So you
okay, yeah. Okay, somebody. So we have how many yeses? There were 20. How many?
Clarity, you want 22. Oh.
Yeah, clarity. And there
no,
were.
No, you want one and not one, two,
two. Oh, is that the way it was? Okay, next question. Is your role in this dream? We're looking at yourself in the dream. Sometimes you can't even know, some people don't even see themselves. But we're looking at the dream self. Is the role proactive or responsive in this dream? And it's important that you make a distinction between responsive and reactive. I'm not talking about reactive. I'm talking about responsive. Is your role in this scene responsive or proactive? Yes? How many yeses? Count those.
Eleven.
And how many no's?
Yeah,
okay.
What do you mean by responsive?
Responsive is. This is difficult, but you're responding to the events in this scene from your center. As opposed to reacting, being rejecting, or being non-passive, or not even there. If you're passive, that's a no. If you're reactive, that's a no. Yes.
If you're an observer in the dream, that would be a passive.
That's a no. That's a no.
Okay, how many no's?
Fearful? Well, we'll get to that. No.
Is that
doesn't apply here. We'll get that's not the question. What are you doing? What is your dream self doing?
Okay, how many no's?
Five. And don't know. Can't tell. Okay, we've got two, three, four, probably the rest of them here. So you got those kinds of options. Now, the next question has to do with your emotions. Are you in this scene, are your emotions high? Are you passionate? And now it can be positive or negative. That we're talking about emotions, period. How many have a high emotion in this? Okay. And how many is it no emotion at all? One.
Two.
Two. And question mark?
Okay.
One.
Two. I thought
two.
Just two.
Two.
Three.
Okay.
This is going to happen.
Okay.
Right. Several. Do it below it. Several. There we go.
Okay. Okay. Now, are you fully expressing this emotion in this scene? Now, let me give you an example of high emotion, no expression. Have you ever had a nightmare where you have a scary thing? Catch me! That's a high emotion, low expression. How many expressions is high in your dream? How many low?
Nine.
And don't know. Okay, we've got three at least.
At least I heard more, I guess. It should be everybody else, right?
Yeah. Okay. Next question is the key word is interaction. Are you interacting with others or beings in this scene, in this dream? Now I'm looking for convergence. Are you interacting or are you withdrawing? There's a divergence. So, are you interacting in this scene with others? Yes or no?
Can I ask a question
Yes.
first? In my dream, I'm observing a scene and watching it.
So that's non-interaction. That's a no-interaction.
Okay. I just wanted to make
yeah.
sure I was understanding what you were saying.
Okay. High interaction.
High interaction.
And no interaction. It can be with entities in the dream. What?
Entities, other entities.
Yes.
But not landscape.
What?
Not landscape or building.
Well, if it's a tree
yeah.
or an animal,
yeah.
that's coming together. That's an interaction. So how many no's again?
It was six.
So we'll just do five.
Okay.
Okay, that's 22.
Now, is this scene complete or resolved? Is there a sense of resolution to it? Yes or no?
Yes.
And how many no's?
Ten. So that's
And I suppose we'll just subtract the difference. Yeah. And now, next question. Yes.
You mean at that time?
Yes, in the dream. In the dream. We're talking about the event itself of the dream. Now, is the scene pleasant in your dream? How many no? How many yeses? Is it pleasant? So how many no's? And in this scene, and this is goes back to the lady that asked earlier, are you secure? Do you feel safe? Yes or no? So we're looking for fear here. Do you feel safe?
Safety, yes.
Yes. Do you feel safe? Yes or no?
Get your hands up
yes.
and hold them up, okay?
Well, then it's a question mark because it's going both ways, and that's something to reach, and that's something to return to. That's the point.
Okay. All right. Not safe.
Not safe. Okay. Do you have a sense of healthy self-esteem or self-worth in this dream? Yes? No? And you can do the math. Now, the next question has to do with authenticity. Are you being authentic in this scene? Yes?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you can tell when you're pretending, if you're assuming some posture. I mean, you have a sense of whether you're being true to yourself in this scene. I've had experiences in dreams where I'm pretending. I'm not coming across like who I am. It's inauthentic. So, yes?
Okay, we've got our hands up. We've got our thinking about it. Okay.
And no.
Okay,
looks like one.
Yep.
Okay. Now the next to the last question is, the key word is becoming. Are you moving in the direction of becoming all you can be towards your higher self? And now, if you can't tell the difference here, look at the opposite. The opposite would be procrastination.
Yes.
So if you're procrastinating, that's going to be a no. So are you becoming all you can be? That's how many yeses? Now, here is the last question. What? Oh, no's. How many no's?
Three no's.
And the next question, last question, is the word beloving. And I want to define it again. Beloving is spending time with someone in such a way that someone experiences his or her own beauty. We're not talking about your experience, we're talking about the experience of the other.
Different word
Are you being beloving of the beings in this scene? Yes or no?
If you're an observer, then that would be a no.
Yes.
Okay. Hey, that's a yes.
How many yeses?
Yes is all.
Seven.
And no's? Okay. Now, if this were a group, if this were a family, for example, or this board of directors I was talking about, I noticed in this particular example the great fear, and there was a lot of anger, and I had changed these, so it wasn't pleasant.
There's pleasantness and security.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. There was fear and insecurity, and these people had met to make decisions, strategic decisions on funds, allocation of funds and policies. And I said, "Look, folks, you've got a lot of stress here, and your dreams are saying that you've got issues to deal with that may be troubling you. And if you can't resolve this anger or this insecurity among yourselves, you're hardly going to be in a position to make good decisions." That was a huge aha for them. And they immediately began addressing and working on interpersonal relationships before they went on with these other decisions. And that's what they needed. And it turned out wonderfully. But that was how I learned, getting put on the spot doing something I didn't know before. But now let's take a look.
Forget to use the mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting that this thing. Okay, so I'm not quite sure how we're going to analyze that if this were a group. But let me just tell you, since you now all have your dreams that you have gone through the process with, one of the things we look for is all the no's or the question marks. We go back and revisit all those question marks or no's. And you can do that. And that's the creating writing process. If you can write a poem, and it doesn't have to be Nobel laureate stuff, just a few key words. The first stanza is the objective one. You write the poem so that it scores exactly the same way as you scored your dream. The second stanza is the subjective one. You get to mess with it. There's no rules here. You can start working with it. I don't like this, or I don't like that. I wish this were different. Anything goes. So there's rules for the first. That's reproduce the dream. The second stanza, start messing with it. The third stanza is making it transformative, where all the questions are answered yes. That's the process. And if you can't do it the first time, your poem, then you get to do it again. That's what a painter does. The same theme, over and over and over, until something transforms and he goes on to another image or another project or another edit. A poet or a...
7 minutes.
So, oh, well, how many have trouble remembering their dreams? Let me tell you that this is the easiest thing in the world. Here's a principle. You will remember your dreams if you want to. And if you want to, you can prepare yourself to remember it. You can suggest to yourself as you go to sleep, "I will remember my dreams in the morning." You can also keep, as I do here, a little pad of paper or something by your bedside, so it doesn't take much energy to write it down when it occurs, and have a writing instrument there so that you don't have to disturb yourself or your wife or your husband. So your psyche, that part of you that produces a dream, will know that's going to comment. that you're serious. And it's really eager to make the relationship. Oh, hello, I've been waiting a long time for this. We have an opportunity to develop a relationship. Yes?
My question is, can you tell us the difference between a nightmare and a dream? And is it true that our dreams only last a few seconds?
No. A nightmare is a dream. And nightmares, I love nightmares. It's so loaded with energy. It's saying, wake up, I need your attention. That part of you that has been desperate or wants to get breakthrough, that's great. If you can accept it rather than run away from it, you have an opportunity to get some very wonderful self-knowledge here. And dreams can go for seconds or a long time. And in my little scheme, there's no such thing as a hierarchy of dreams. Oh, they're all meaningful. Yes?
If you can't remember them, could it be that you're trying to suppress your shadow? You don't want to.
Yeah, good question. If you can't remember them, are you trying to repress them, or is it your shadow? Yes, I believe that. I believe your ego is blocking. Remember, the dream bypasses the ego. It does not come from the ego. The ego does not want to be robbed of what it perceives as job. And ego is not doing its job if it takes over. It's a very bad manager. Yes?
Do children have especially strong dreams? Is there something, my children seem to struggle at night. Is there something about the way child's brain works?
Well, that's a good question about children. Do children have strong dreams? And you know, I haven't worked with children, but I work with high school students, and especially at high school, and there was a lot of fear and insecurity. I realized there are big problems here, both in the school and in the home life. I think, and if you want to listen, if they'll tell you your dreams, write them down, keep them, date them. You know, that's gold. You can tell. And then if you use this little scheme, there may be a way that you can have them rework this, or you can work, if it's a nightmare, work them through. And you can bring heroes in. You can bring Captain Moroni in, or Joseph Smith if he's your hero, or Jesus. You can bring anything. There's no limit on your imagination in reworking this dream. Yes? Go ahead, lady.
What is the advantage of reworking the dream?
Oh, that's a very good question. What is the advantage of reworking a dream? It is a transformative process. It is the creative process. If you put your imagination to work and transform it, it will change you. And you can track this process by tracking your dreams, keeping track, over time, watch how your dreams evolve, or the theme. Sometimes there'll be a particular theme that repeats. Watch that change. It's a wonderful process. Yes.
Could you clarify the writing part of the particular subjective and transforming part of that? What do you do there?
Well, again, rewrite it. Just a few key words, a little poem, a little statement, the objective, so that it scores the same way as the dream scored.
And the subjective and then the
transformative.
And the subjective one is you can rewrite it. You see, maybe you can't make it transform all at once. Well, that's fine. You start with it. I don't like this. Or I accept this. Or this is exciting. Or whatever. You can start working. There's no rules about what you can write about the subjective dream or the subjective stanza. So, you know, that can be anything you want. It's just the
last.
Yeah, there are video examples on the website. Yeah, of this workshop. Yes.
May I just read a few lines? Maybe that will help them. It's just a few lines. I just did it.
Yes.
Okay. So the dream was that my niece's wedding last week. They saw big tent wrapped in the band of the Lake of the Culture Hall. It's called the Tent Club. Objective.
Oh, ma'am, would you come up so we can hear you?
Sure.
So you just went through. You went through the process.
Yeah, I did, and it's just a few like...
Just read your dream,
yeah.
Or your poem.
Wedding tent collapsing dreams. Objective. Watching the tent collapse. Hundreds suffocate at a wedding. Subjective. I'm suffering. Piled on dead bodies. No air. Dead bride. Dead groom. Transformative. The tent protects us all. It bellows like clouds. Sun is shining through.
That's a very wonderful example. Wonderful example. Is that it?
Yeah.
We're gone. Thank you for being here. I hope something happened with you while we're in this process.